to be successful in the Artist Alley here, I think you need to be part of the programming. Mm-hmm. Because even if people haven't come to your table yet, if you are a speaker at the graphic arts stage, you're going to get 30, 40, 50 people there to hear you talk about graphic novels for young adults or graphic novels for preteens. And then they get invited back to your table later in the convention.
This is Joseph Coco. I'm at ALA 2018, the annual conference here in New Orleans. I'm here on behalf of Becky Hilburn's Art Process YouTube channel and blog. If you could introduce yourself, Richard.
My name is Richard Green, and I'm a collector, an illustrator, and graphic designer.
Okay.
I'm married to a librarian, and that's what brings me to the American Library Association conferences.
Fantastic. And you've been doing this for a long time, collecting. What got you into it to start?
I started out as a young kid. I had a Sunday school teacher who was a comic collector.
Okay.
And we're still lifelong friends. He's in his 80s now. But starting when I graduated high school and got out into the working world, together with him and four other people, we began to produce comic book conventions in the mid-70s in the Philadelphia area. They were the first ones in the Philadelphia area.
Okay.
And I started collecting cartoon and comic artwork, as well as the comic books themselves.
All right. And how different were comic conventions back then? Obviously, Beck and I haven't been doing them for nearly as long as you have. Firstly, what made you decide that it was best for you to start your own? And secondly, how would you say have comic book conventions changed in the past 30 years or so?
Well, I hope we have enough digits to listen to this whole thing. But at the time, the only major convention on the East Coast was Phil Sewell's comic art convention in New York City.
Okay.
And it was the 4th of July weekend every year, and it was legendary. And he had only been doing them for a few years when I started going to them. And there were none in the Philadelphia area, and so a bunch of us that would trek to New York to spend a weekend with a bunch of great comic artists and writers decided, why don't we do one in the Philadelphia area, bring one down to South Jersey.
Yeah.
And so we did one about 15 minutes outside of Center City, Philadelphia, starting in 75. And we were doing conventions in shopping malls. We got media attention, and the manager of the Cherry Hill Mall in New Jersey, which was the first shopping mall in America, she saw it in the news. And so she approached us and said, how would you like to do a comic convention in our malls?
Wow.
And that kind of worked out neat.
Yeah.
So that was kind of we did that for a couple years. We did it for about 3 years doing conventions. And then we kind of lost interest in it, and a lot of us lives took different directions.
Yeah.
And but at that time, there were no conventions with ex-wrestlers and faded TV stars and such.
Right.
And it was all about the comics themselves and the art and the stories.
Yeah.
And they were pretty much like big parties. We would rent a hotel for a weekend, sell dealers' tables to pay for the room nights that covered the artists so we could invite them and pay for a room overnight.
Yeah.
And it was a party. And we put fans and artists and writers together.
And were these big name people that the public would know? Or was it independent people?
Yeah, people like Roy Thomas and Frank Thorne and Gene Colan. A lot of legendary people, Jim Steranko, people that are legends today, were very approachable and accessible. And Charles Vest, Mike Peruta. I could just go on and on naming people that came to these conventions as guests and became friends.
Yeah.
So in a lot of cases, we were putting these artists together who had admired each other's work, but never met. And so it was a meeting place for them too.
Okay.
To socialize and get together.
Yeah, and that definitely is pretty similar to how some of the like SPS and SPX and Mocha Fest and those sort of conventions are now. But some of those conventions are becoming a little less about comic book artists. So, certainly NYCC and SDCC and those sort of things have long moved on from that. But
well, the industry was much different then. You had your big mainstream companies like Marvel and DC and Charlton, to a lesser extent. It was always considered the ugly stepchild of the comic book industry, but had great stuff. And people like Joe Staton and Nick Cuddy were working there and doing wonderful stuff. so you had the mainstream market, and you had the underground comics that had come out of San Francisco and Chicago and New York in the late 60s and early 70s. People like Jay Lynch and Ron Turner's Last Gasp, those people, they were the alternate comics of their day.
Yeah.
And some of it was autobiographical self-stories by the writers. A lot of it was, but it was also drugs and sex and rock and roll. And they were the black sheep of the family of the comic world.
Yeah.
But we were putting them together because we loved all the artwork and the writers from both worlds. Now you still have your underground comics, but it's become more considered alternative press. So places like Small Press Expo, Comic Arts Brooklyn, Mocha Fest are where all these young artists and people just coming into the industry are using the comics medium as a form of self-expression.
Right.
And we love, my wife Kathy and I, who is a librarian, we love going to these because we meet all this fresh young talent.
Yeah. So you got into collecting. What would you say a collector is looking for at those sort of comic book conventions? Do you just want to browse around and see everything, or are there particular artists, like maybe fresh faces, like you said, you haven't seen before? Are you also coming to see the people that you know? Like,
It's all of those things. You know, it's like old home week. You come and you see people that you've known for years. Mm-hmm. You may already have art by them. Perhaps it's a chance to get a piece of art by them, or talk to a writer that you've admired and their stories that you like.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing. But it's also, we love the serendipity of coming to one of these conventions and seeing somebody for the first time. Somebody who maybe this is their first convention as an exhibitor and display, and it's a journey of personal discovery to find somebody. So finding Becca, for example, at this convention has been a real delight. You know, and I hope it's
glad to hear
a long term. No, I hope it becomes a long term relationship because now that Kathy and I are the old guard, we can make introductions and network and connect, and it is all about networking.
Sure,
it really is.
Okay. And how would you say, having been to a lot of these independent comic conventions and come to ALA, you guys have been to, you've been to several ALAs.
Many ALAs, BLA, ALA Midwinter,
yeah.
BEA, Book Expo America.
Okay,
yeah,
how would you say the Artist Alley here is different than just a conventional independent comic convention?
Oh, much, much smaller.
Yeah.
Too small.
Yeah.
In our experience. Has been that while you get great people here, great talent, there aren't as many people here as should be.
Yeah. Do you think librarians would come to the Artist Alley more if it was a bigger section of the
exhibition? I think so. Yeah. It's interesting to be successful in the Artist Alley here. I think you need to be part of the program,
mm-hmm.
because even if people haven't come to your table yet, if you are a speaker at the graphic arts stage, you're going to get 30, 40, 50 people there to hear you talk about graphic novels for young adults or graphic novels for preteens, and then they get invited back to your table later in the convention,
mm-hmm.
and they'll say, oh, that was interesting, I want to go check them out.
Yeah, and they've got friends who are here as well, so hopefully they'll bring some other people by.
Exactly right, or somebody they know needs to know about it at their home library.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an important thing is getting involved in one of the programs somewhere, either an outside conference room or the stage here in the convention hall.
Okay, that's good to know. And you said the size is different. How do you feel about how people are approaching librarians? Like, are you being greeted the same way at these conventions? Are people pitching to you the same way at these conventions? Are you able to spend one-on-one time with them the same as independent comic conventions?
You get to spend more time and more quality time here at this convention. The mainstream conventions like Big Apple Con or the New York Comic Con, or God forbid San Diego, it's so frenetic and so mobbed, and everybody's got to be somewhere else all the time.
Yeah.
It's hard to find quality time. I'm sure it can happen, but the odds are against you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas here,
you pretty much have to meet up after the convention to do that.
You can stand at somebody's table and talk to them for 5 or 10 minutes. You can go to dinner with them or lunch. You can grab a bite to eat here on the convention floor or whatever and spend a little time.
Okay.
And discover them and network with them.
Okay.
So that's an important aspect of these, of the library and book shows. The other interesting thing is the generation of, the young generation of librarians that are coming up grew up on graphic novels and comics, so they have a much greater appreciation.
Yeah.
At one time,
and there's quite a few young people at this show. It's not
a lot. Yeah. You know, we're talking about librarians under 35. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a whole generation of them now that come to these conventions. And at one time, my mother was a library director, and she always encouraged us to read comic books. Anything that gets kids reading is beloved by librarians. They want
that
kids
has been
to read it.
A common message at ALA, as far as I can tell. So it's not just a small group of people who are looking for comics. It seems to be pervasive.
It's universal among librarians that anything that gets kids reading is good. And especially young readers, early readers, you know, words and pictures together, children's books are words and pictures together, well, so are comics and short graphic novels.
Yeah.
It enables the kid to identify, like, oh, car, that's a picture of a car. Oh, that must be the word for a car. And they learn to read that way. There's a certain amount.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating. In here and at the alternative comics conventions, you see more books and magazines aimed at very young readers.
Right.
You go to the mainstream comic conventions
and
it's violence and sex scenes and, you know, superhero stuff. And yes, they're telling stories about diversity and acceptance and you know, justice will out and that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a few aimed at young readers. Excuse me.
Okay. And you'd mentioned ALA Midwinter. That's something Becca and I haven't done. We've been told that there isn't really an artist alley in the Midwinter. Is that your experience?
Excuse me. Well, one of the aspects of all these book conventions is that there's not only an artist alley usually,
mm-hmm.
but there's a section, a zine section, for people that are self-publishing magazines.
Yeah.
And all the independent publisher exhibitors that have a booth in the hall quite often have artists.
Right.
So at Midwinter, you're more apt to have IDW or Lion Forge or Manga Classics.
Yeah,
or,
so there's definitely going to be independent artists
Image
represented.
Comics.
They'll
be at those
booths. They might not be creators unless they're just at those booths. Yeah.
They're doing signings at those booths.
Yeah.
Some hang around for the whole show at those booths. And then quite often there is some sort of an artist alley at Midwinter.
Okay.
And I think that there will be more and more.
Sounds good.
I'm hoping that
do you get the same sort of vibe at the Midwinter show as you
very
do at
much
the annual
the
conference?
It's just smaller. And it's only every other year, Midwinter.
Yeah.
The other convention that's an annual is PLA, the Public Library Association.
I would love to hear about that.
And
we
that's
haven't
another
actually
good
looked
one.
Into it much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's another. I was just in Philadelphia. I don't know where it is next. I'm not even sure
but
where
it is.
But
it's a traveling convention just like ALA.
ALA's in New Orleans this week, but next year it'll be in Seattle.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So we're looking forward. And when that happens, you get a different crop of artists and writers because the publishers, the exhibitors, and the artist alley will draw from local talent.
Of course. That was one of the things that drew us this year is because Beck and I are both from New Orleans, so we thought
we would have
a better chance, can also meet back up with friends and things. So, I feel like you're probably going to get people who are, a decent amount of people who are tied to the area, depending on where the show is.
And in the Northwest, you've got the Vancouver, Bellingham, Seattle, Portland area, where there's a lot of great talent.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be a great show for people that are interested in graphic arts, narrative illustration, I like to call it.
Okay.
That's a different way to think of it, is narrative illustration.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about your comics collection? How much of the pieces, or comics art collection, how much of the pieces do you have hanging up? How much of the pieces do you have in storage? Or
Kathy and I are fortunate. We have a large Victorian house in New Jersey, South Jersey, where we're from. And having started before I met her in the early 70s, I started collecting not just comic book art, but newspaper strip art, political cartoons, gag panels. As I co-produced the conventions and met a lot of artists, I would get pieces of art from them, buying, trading, collecting with other collectors, selling for them, representing some of the artists sometimes, selling their paintings. But my taste in illustration art, American illustration, expanded beyond narrative illustration or panel art, as some people call comics and cartoons, into book illustration. So the cover paintings for paperback books and pulp magazines, the classic pulps in the 30s. A lot of artists like Boris Vallejo and Tim Hildebrand and Lauren Schwinger and some others became good friends of mine. And I sold paintings for them. And I always took my commission in art because they could afford to be more generous with art than they could with the money. They needed the money.
Yeah.
So, you know, you sell a painting for X thousand dollars and you can have 10% of the money or a painting.
You don't have to be tied into that community, so it's probably not that difficult for you to help them move a piece. So
exactly,
building your collection and building more connections with people at the same time.
And the other thing that, so now Kathy and I find ourselves with a collection of well over 1,000 pieces of artwork.
Okay.
And there's probably...
That's amazing.
There's probably 60 to 70 pieces hanging around.
Because you're talking about original artwork, to
original,
be clear,
no
not
prints. I like the uniqueness of having an original, one of a kind, as opposed to a print.
Yeah.
You know, sure, there's a portfolio of prints somewhere in the house, but where we stash stuff, that just kind of falls into your lap. But but for the most part, you know, we enjoy living with it and displaying it. For example, when my wife and I got engaged, she got a diamond ring and I got a Joe Shuster Superman strip, you know, from her, from 1941, an original pen and ink by Joe Shuster, signed by him with a photo with him in the picture, you know, and that's a pretty neat piece. So we enjoy living with that on the walls.
Yeah.
I mean, the way I look at it, you can buy a stock certificate that may or may not go up and fluctuate in value and put it in a safe deposit box somewhere and never see it. Whereas you can have that piece of artwork on your wall and enjoy it every day.
Enriches your life. Yeah, and you've also helped artists build culture.
In many ways.
As opposed to stocks, which is just personal gain for the most part.
Right. And can go up and down and fluctuate. But I'll tell you, the illustration art has pretty consistently gone up in value. You know, you're
it's
not seeing Frazetta originals drop in price.
Yeah.
You know, there's that. But at the same time, also, starting in 78, I wish I'd started it in 75, but in 78, I started taking a blank sketchbook, you know, a hardback book of blank paper, to the conventions that I was co-producing, and getting the friends and artists that were coming to those conventions to draw right in those books. And I'm now up to book number 7. So the first 6, there's about 100 artists in each book. Each page, a different...
Spanning a long period of time. Lots of different people, different places.
Like 40 years worth.
Yeah.
And you know, there was a long period of time where they languished and I wasn't doing, you know, I was working and raising a family, so I wasn't going to conventions much, so there was a big gap for a while. But I try and get at least a book a year filled with artists. And it's new people I've met, people I've admired for years, people I've known for years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a variety, and it's a very unique way to look at a period of history of cartoon and comic art.
Yeah.
And more people are doing that now. I see a lot of sketchbooks.
Yeah, I see young people, I see older
people. It's become a real trendy thing.
Yeah.
But in 1978, there weren't many people doing it. There were a few. Mm-hmm. There was a few of us. And to see one of those what we call dinosaurs, you know, that's been lying fallow for years, mm-hmm. all of a sudden come to the surface and see that and go through it. Like the first book, the one I started in 78, has 5 EC comic artists, you know, which is remarkable because a lot of those people have gone
last night.
So you do see that. But for my sketchbooks, because I have a world, a foot in the comic book world and the alternative comic world and undergrounds, and then also in the book world where there's children's book illustrators and fine artists, you see these books are much more diverse than somebody who only goes to comic book conventions, mainstream comic book conventions. Great collection of superheroes and villains, but you don't see children's book illustrators in there, and you don't see political cartoonists. So Rob Rogers, who was just fired by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for not drawing Trump-positive cartoons, he just got fired because, you know, he was being true to his beliefs in what he was cartooning. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got him in three different sketchbooks, and, you know, because I've known him for years. Okay. So you know, you're finding people that have, I believe, culturally historic significance in these books as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing when I start to look through the early books and I see, I must have 200 or more Eisner Award winners and Nebula winners and you know, people that have won the
people who are getting accolades after you've known them for long periods of time.
Exactly, or won those awards over the years. You know, I was fortunate enough to meet a lot of these people before they were award winners, but I recognized their talent and I wanted to get them in the book.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So, what I was trying to get at earlier with your collections is it sounds like you try to have a personal connection to the art.
I prefer that.
A little more than just meeting them. So, how would you feel if someone actually contacted you and said, I've got some art pieces, would you be interested in them?
Always interested in looking and listening. I mean, there's no harm in that. If I can afford it, maybe I would. If it's something I like and I can afford it.
Right. I was just curious. I haven't met too many comic art collectors or art collectors in general, so I wasn't sure how you felt about that. If the personal connection was required or if you just
It's not required. It's nice. It's always an added bonus.
So you have some type of
If I can get a picture of myself and the artist together, you know, with a piece of artwork, that's great. And it's documentation of provenance of collecting the things. But it's not necessary. It's not essential.
Okay. And you are an artist yourself.
I am a graphic designer and illustrator. I work for a great guy, Leslie Cabargo, as an airbrush illustrator, studio assistant working for him. I work for toy companies. Now my career for the last 10 years or so has been primarily as a designer of books and magazines.
Okay.
For different publishers.
Right. And how much art are you creating for fun versus doing it for fun?
I do very little for fun.
Okay.
To me, it's my admiration for people that can draw and I can watch those images flow out of those pens effortlessly, it knows no bounds. My admiration for them knows no bounds because it is just remarkable to me. For me to draw something and create something that I'm satisfied with or willing to let somebody else look at is hard. It's difficult. It's really tough. So I don't draw for fun. I can doodle. I can sketch. Functioning as an art director or a creative director, I can draw enough to get my concept and idea across to somebody that I'm paying to do the real hard work.
That's
where it's at.
Okay. And I know we discussed last night how you got into the airbrushing, but what made you continue to explore using airbrushing?
Well, I was lucky.
It just doesn't seem like it's that common of a...
I got involved in a blue-collar trade, airbrush auto body repair and painting. Mm-hmm. And part of that started to use touch-up guns and small spray paint equipment to do motorcycle tanks and the sides of vans and do illustration. And you got to realize that during that whole time, I was also, as an avocation, you know, vocation was painting the cars, but the avocation was running comic book conventions and collecting and running around with other people, wheeling and dealing in comic books and comic art.
Yeah.
So it was only a natural extension to begin to use the artist's airbrush. As a medium,
instead of a car airbrush.
Yeah. So Cabarga, who is one of the leading airbrush illustrators, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, doing covers for Time, Newsweek, and Fortune magazine, album covers, all the Betty Boop greeting cards for Paper Moon Graphics. Meeting him and having him as a friend before I graduated art school was just kind of a natural segue into that.
Okay.
Congratulations.
And finally, would you have any advice? Where can we find your work online if somebody wanted to hire you to do something? Do you take freelance?
I don't have a website, which is kind of weird, but no, not really. I'm not chasing work. I'm not looking for people to find me. I'm at a point now where I would much rather generate the project by putting together a publisher and an artist and say, let me design the book.
You know how to orchestrate things.
Joe DeVito, the cover artist, I mean, he's done all the Doc Savage book covers for over 20 years. He's done hundreds and hundreds of book covers. Is a friend, and he owns the intellectual property King Kong of Skull Island. And he wanted to do a book to lock down his intellectual property in book form.
Okay.
And he asked me to design the book, and I was very proud to do it. It's gorgeous. We only printed 500 copies. It's a 268-page hardback with a slipcase and parchment paper, gloss paper.
Went all out for the people who are dedicated
fans. Big.
Yeah.
And there's less than 100 copies left now. And it's also available as a Nook online digital book, and there'll be an on-demand paperback version in 2 volumes. But again, you know, getting involved with him to design the book was a thrill. I mean, because I'm a King Kong fan, and who isn't? And I'm a Joe DeVito fan. Joe's also done a lot of book covers for Edgar Rice Burroughs Incorporated, ERB Incorporated, which is the estate of Edgar Rice Burroughs. So being involved in Kong and Burt and Tarzan and John Carter of Mars and all of that sort of stuff it feeds my love of that kind of genre, you know, fantasy and adventure and stuff like that.
Okay.
But I'm also working with David Spurlock of Vanguard Publishing.
I know.
Yeah, it does all those great art books of Frazetta, and we're now working on a book of the paintings of Daniel Horn, who is a historic illustrator and a painter of horror subjects. One of his paintings was in the movie Crimson Peak. And I put Spurlock and Horn together to do a book project together. I took them both to dinner and said, let's do a book. Because nobody had done a book on Daniel Horn. And that's the fun. That's where I'm at now in my career, is putting people together and saying, hey, let's do this.
Okay. And finally, would you have any advice to an artist who's considering tabling at ALAAC for the first time?
My advice, you know, it's great to jump into the deep end of the pool. That's great. But if there's any way you can attend one first, wouldn't be a bad idea.
Yeah, definitely if you have some association with the library, try to get in on that.
Okay, here's a good way to look at it. If you can go to your state library association conference, every state does, sometimes 2 or 3 states will run one together. But for example, the New Jersey Library Association, the Texas Library Association is the largest association conference in the country for librarians.
Okay.
The Texas Library Association, it's usually in Austin or Dallas or Houston, because those are the places big enough to handle it.
Yeah.
Go to one of those state ones first and see, and then realize that ALA or PLA or ALA Midwinter are 100 times bigger than that.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's great to somehow get a table in Artist Alley at ALA, but you're jumping into the deep end.
Right.
If you've done the New York Comic Con or Big Apple Con
or
Emerald City or one of the big conventions, okay, it's more genteel and calm than that. Okay, but it's about that size. You know, it's going to be that big. The other thing is try and get involved in the program.
Yeah.
You know, find out who's moderating the panels, what panels are they looking to put together, and can you fit into one of those?
Okay, if you're a young woman artist, trying to pitch your own thing, you say, hey, I'm familiar enough with this topic. I see you have 3 speakers. Could I join that?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, you're a young woman cartoonist, illustrator, who's doing books, not unlike Becca. you know, who has already published, self-published perhaps, a half a dozen pieces, or done some mainstream commercial work, approach them and say, hey, I can talk about women's issues in young adult graphic novels.
Yeah.
I'd like to be on that panel. I have the bona fides, I have the pedigree to be on that panel. And that's the way to get in there. That's a good way to get in there.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's been great talking to you. It's great to see somebody collecting comic art and supporting people here. You said you shipped back, what, seven boxes so far. Books and comics
and not
and
just
art.
Graphic novels and stuff. Yeah. It's fiction. A lot of it's gifts for other people.
Yeah. Well, we definitely appreciate you coming by and supporting the comic art.
Hey, it's fun. The fun never stops.
All right, well, thank you so much for letting me interview you. I think you gave some good insights of what people are looking for at the convention.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Up and Conning Artist. A video version is available on the Natasoup YouTube channel, along with some convention recaps. And if you wouldn't mind, please consider supporting Becky Hilburn by contributing to her Patreon or checking out her Tiny People comic at 7inchkara.com and wherever books are sold.